In today's episode, I speak with Miriam Chandunelli, who's a legal tech founder in the field of legal documents in one place with Lawformer. Lawformer gives you a chance to create a personal library of documents, manage contract knowledge, find relevant contract clauses, and in general, like create a legal setup for lawyers, which I find really interesting. We talked about how they build that software, what it solves, and also about like women founding companies and the differences. And I think it was like a really, really cool talk. So happy to have you here, and let's start in this episode. Okay, so welcome back to the Digital Economics Podcast. Today I talk with Miriam Chandunelli, who's the legal tech founder of Lawformer. Miriam, can you please tell what you do at Lawformer and what Lawformer actually is?
Hi, Luis, and thanks for having me on the podcast. As you mentioned, my name is Miriam Chandunelli. I'm a legal tech founder at a startup called Lawformer. So mainly what Lawformer does is we're trying to streamline the contract drafting and negotiation process for legal professionals, because that's one of the most time-consuming aspects of their job. And we do so by, you know, providing them with an attorney-drafted clause library that they can use to build their contracts with, and also AI-powered contract deconstruction tool that helps them build their personalized clause libraries and leverage their internal knowledge in one place, so that the next time when they're working on negotiating or building legal documents, they can basically pull information from their existing library and they don't have to look this information within databases and folders and emails that is currently scattered all over. So that's basically the problem there that we're trying to solve with our startup.
Is it so who's the target audience? Is it for freelancers or for agencies or for like big companies who have a legal team but who are annoyed by legal stupid legal stuff? Like who are your target audience? Who is your target audience?
So given that we have sort of two products within Lawformer, so within our digital clause library, it can be any legal professional working on contracts that we find is useful. But with Lawformer AI, although there is a B2C aspect to it, we primarily approach it as a B2B product. So for that, our main customers are large in-house legal teams, as well as law firms that are struggling with this, you know, time-consuming aspect of contract drafting and negotiation. So mostly transactional legal teams that are involved in contract drafting and negotiation. Those are our primary customers and target audience.
How sure? So you're using AI to develop the contracts? How sure can you be that it's like really, really 100% something you can rely on? A quick note about today's sponsor, GoatSign. GoatSign enables you to digitally sign your documents, allowing you to completely leave printed paperwork behind. I use GoatSign myself, and it saves me a lot of time and hassle. If you're a freelancer, you probably know the problem. You have contracts, you have proposals, agreements, etc. And honestly, for me, that's like a really annoying part of my daily operations. But now I simplify this a little bit with just a few clicks and securely and legally signed contracts with GoatSign. It's not just a tool, it's more like a pioneer for leaner, more efficient workway. No printer is needed, no scanner, no reordering cartridges, no waiting in the line at the post office. Digital signatures really support my freedom to work from everywhere. And being location independent. With GoatSign, you can focus on the things which really matter, which is in the end your work, your creativity, the things you do and love, and you have a chance to streamline your processes.
So we are not using AI to develop or build contracts. So what we are doing with the AI is, so lawyers, let's assume, they are uploading their existing library of contracts that they have within like different databases. And so our AI powered tool, you know, breaks that down into individual clauses and organizes these clauses into a digital library that they will then use to build next contracts with, so that when they're building a contract, they can already use their confidentiality clause or termination clause that they previously used, and they can pull this information from their personal library within seconds, because they can use keyword search, or they can filter these clauses by contract types. There are, you know, different user journeys there, but the idea is that we do not create contracts for them. The idea is that they generate new contracts with the knowledge that they already have in-house. Because I will explain some of the journey that we went through with developing our product. Something that we are really proud of is that we sort of like built our main product with the customer feedback. So initially we started with the digital clause library, the attorney drafted digital clause library that lawyers could use to build their product with. So within the first 3 months, we onboarded around more than like 600 beta users. And so this digital clause library was sorted and organized by different contract types. So you would go into it and you would see clauses that would be typically required for employment agreement or service agreement or SaaS contract or NDA, different types of contracts. So the feedback, the very consistent feedback that we were getting from our customers at that point, beta users, was we love the way that the content is organized on the platform, but we want our own content to be organized the same way. So that instead of using other attorney drafted clauses, we can use our own clauses. But the problem at this moment of using our own clauses is that it's hard to gather all this information when we need it. So basically, we understood in this process of building LawFirmer that the main problem that transactional teams were facing is knowledge management. So law firms have this wealth of information, data, contracts, documents that they are not leveraging properly because it's not organized. It exists in a chaotic format. And for a legal professional, your main asset that you're offering to your client is knowledge. So your ability to leverage and use this knowledge as effectively as possible really increases the value that you're providing for your client. So, and that's the purpose of LawFirmer as well, because legal tech isn't just about helping the legal professional. Obviously, it is important, but legal tech is also about making, you know, law and justice and that field more accessible for the client as well, so that we provide them with the more accessible services, better service delivery, increased quality, etc. And so we in some ways help the end user, which is the legal professional, but also individuals who are using legal services from legal professionals too.
So your end user is a legal professional, but this end user is also providing his customers like kind of your service, but in a white labeled version, where probably his title is standing on it, and like his users can or her users can input like, okay, that is what I need, and then it's taking all the different information from already existing contracts.
So the legal professionals would be using our resources to draft contracts. And then obviously these contracts are shared with their clients, but their clients aren't necessarily interested in like, what type of technology did you use to draft this contract quicker than you would like 2 months ago? So the idea is that within the legal industry, there's more demand for efficiency now because, you know, clients like individuals are asking questions such as like, what are you doing to make your service delivery more efficient? Because if we consider the economic model of law, most of legal teams and law firms still charge by hour, right? They bill by hour. So what you're paying for is the time rather than the product. So obviously, as someone who is using the legal service from a law firm, it is your best interest to make sure that they deliver in the most efficient manner and that time isn't wasted on stuff that can be automated, for example. And in fact, to that, I would say that there was very interesting research that was published a few months ago that says that lawyers typically spend roughly 21 to 25% of their day looking for information. And that includes like, you know, contracts and clauses and memos and details, etc. And when you think about it, that's basically a huge portion of your day spent on like really mundane, time-consuming things that could be automated, so that then you can spend, as a legal professional, spend a lot of your valuable time on things such as like client work or strategy or innovating and doing things that will actually make you as an individual or your law firm competitive on already very competitive market.
Like,
that's the point as well.
So I consider it something like a page builder, like for websites. I guess it since 2000 or something, it's normal for many like agencies that they just have some click dummies where they put stuff already existing elements together, maybe just changing the texts and something like this, but for the legal stuff.
So basically what you're getting with LawFirmer is your customized library of information. And then that for us, the next step is to make sure that this information, your library, is connected to like common document builders, such as like Google Docs and Word, for example. So when you're working on a document, right, let's say you're working on an employment agreement and you need a confidentiality clause, you can basically look up and say, what is the confidentiality clause that someone in my position used 2 weeks ago in a similar type of contract? So basically you have this information at your fingertips and you don't have to call, you know, your colleague or send an email saying, oh, like, would this clause be okay to be used? Because you already have like a precedent in front of you that you can apply, and you have like intelligence to see this is the type of clauses that are okay for these type of contracts. And also intelligence to say, these clauses, for example, neutral by nature, this is like party A favorable, this is party B favorable, we need to try go easy on that, and that kind of information. But it is helpful for anyone involved in the contract negotiation, contract drafting process, because that just makes things so much quicker. But it's especially helpful for onboarding new people within law firm, because that's so much time saved on like supervision, because we've all been there, right? As legal professionals, you go into law firm, your university didn't really provide you with like much practical training on like how to work on contracts. But when you go into law firm, they already expect you to have a lot of these skills. So there's a gap somewhere that, you know, nobody kind of gives you this practical knowledge. And so as a newbie, you're like, is it okay to do? Are you, every time you put something in there, you want to ask someone. And then you don't want to be a burden on our partner's shoulders. And you just, you know, it's a struggle. We've all experienced that. So with tools like that, you can already have a lot of this information in one system in front of you to say, oh, you know, like the partner used this clause in similar type of contract already 2 weeks ago. So this should be okay to use. And once you have the final contract, then you can send it to for review to your supervisor. And that's so much sort of like time spent on, you know, back and forth, which, you know, it is a lot of time, and it doesn't have to be. It can be easier than that.
Do you also take the input which is given like from your clients to train like your large language model?
Yeah, so obviously to make sure that the model is as accurate in deconstructing and providing intelligence as possible, we need to train it on like large data sets of information. So yes, and in fact, like, we are trying to partner with some law firms in order to make sure that the tool is really customized to their needs, and to make sure that the way it's deconstructing it, it reflects the style and the formatting of their contracts, because that's something that differs from like one law firm to another. So yes, that's something that we are very much invested in, and we're always very welcoming towards that. In fact, like, we provide partnership you know, like exchange of information for the sake of the ability to test the product, use it, and see if that's something that can be useful for your legal team. So definitely.
What could be a problem like with getting new clients is that clients are aware or like afraid of you at one point replacing them as partners, because you have such an amazing database of like information and how legal contracts should be, etc., that you are like, yeah, okay, on one side, of course, we have maybe partners, but we also could we could skip the partner, the legal team, and immediately advise like the end customer. How do you reply to that concern?
That's a good question. We don't provide legal service. We're a legal tech startup, so that's already in our disclaimer. We don't claim to be a law firm. That's a very different legal setup, and we don't have the right to be providing legal advice. That's one thing. So that there's no chance that we will do that anytime soon. And we also want to continue to operate in that space. So doing that once will guarantee that there's not a single company on the planet that wants to do business with us, especially in industries like law, where everything is word of mouth, which we will talk about it later. So yeah, that's not possible. And of course, like, we're bound by confidentiality agreement when we're not able to use their information and contracts for, you know, providing services to third parties. So that's something that will be, you know, included in the provisions of our partnership early on. So yeah,
I mean, I guess you have really tough partners who really read their contracts and know what they're saying. But does this mean that everyone gets their own kind of LLM set up, or how does it work that it's like really, really confidential?
No, they wouldn't get their own LLM set up, but they would get their personalized dashboard. So the contracts that they upload and, you know, like deconstruct and build their libraries with would only be accessible to them. And so those contracts would not be used for other clients. That's the idea. So every single user has their own personalized dashboard. But if they want to provide wider, like, law firm access to it, that's something that we can provide. But that information that the law firm or particular legal team provides to us doesn't go beyond that legal team. So that's something that we keep, you know, strictly confidential within our you know, product journey.
So you're on the legal end, so probably like a techie could answer it better, but you would make you're for sure making sure that information I provide as a legal team never has the chance to be like learned from the LLM and used then by another team, even if it's not like word by word, but in general learned by the LLM, which your company did as a setup. Yeah.
Yes, definitely, because a lot of the information you'll be providing, whether it's a memo or a contract, might also contain sensitive information. So we can't let that happen. That's one thing that we have to keep stripped. That's why I was also mentioning that if you want to make sure that one particular legal team has the best version of the LLM possible, and that they use it on the type of contracts that they provide, the formatting and everything, then they would be using their own database to train it with, which would only be available to them within the process.
You mentioned that in the first round you had 600 users. How did you do that? I think that's an impressive amount, especially for a tooling which is, I guess, hard to sell because I guess it's an old industry.
Yeah. It is quite hard. So most of those 600 people were beta users. So obviously they were not paid customers, but it's still very hard to find that many people to test your product and provide feedback. So I think one thing that helped is that most of the founders, 4 out of 5 founders of Lawfirmer, are, you know, people in the legal space. We're all lawyers by background. So we, in the first couple of months, we massively leveraged our own contacts and people that we knew. So we had all studied law, we had all done LLMs as well as undergrad, we had all worked in legal teams and law firms. So a lot of those people came from our professional networks. And then we started developing partnerships with some law firms and industry associations where we provided access to, like, entry-level legal professionals to law firms and said, this is something you can test, see if it's useful, it's free, and all we need from you is to provide some sort of a feedback on what can be improved. It was really hard because it took basically like reaching out to every single person individually and convincing them about the value of wasting 15 minutes of their day testing something. But I think, like, it comes down to really explaining the value of your product properly. So if you're going to an entry-level legal professional, let's say like it's a law student or someone just getting started with their career, what you really try to show them is, this is going to help you improve your contract drafting skills. This is also going to help you improve your legal tech skills, both of which are highly demanded in the legal industry, and you have the opportunity to do that for free. So, and you have the opportunity to be part of something that we're just now building that has potential to be successful. And you will know, like, if you communicate with people in the right way and give them the value that they would potentially want to see, it is possible. And as we said afterwards, it's very important to think of the networks that you can tap into. The legal market is, as you mentioned earlier, very, very conservative, and a lot of it still depends on word of mouth. So I'll be very honest with you. Traditional marketing or digital marketing almost, I would say, doesn't work in legal tech, because lawyer would only use your product if they know another lawyer who's already using your product. So you have to make sure that you leverage that as much as possible. Like, join industry organizations, network with people, go to legal tech conferences, build your network, invest in self-branding, you know, just make sure that you ask for introductions from people that you already know, and it snowballs from there. Because if you just rely on like digital marketing or traditional sales and think that it's going to bring you clients, it's really not going to work. Because law is a very difficult industry to penetrate, still very conservative, still quite a lot of resistance to using legal tech or solutions that are not, you know, commonly used. We see a lot of innovation in the legal tech space. There's a lot happening. There's a lot of hype now with AI. But in order to actually be able to sell your product, you will have to leverage those personal connections. Because that's still how things work.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think you get these personal connections? Mostly via university, or do you have some other strategies? Because I think that's actually something I hear a lot, and I always then wonder, like, yeah, but how do you get these connections?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Let's get into details. Or, for example, in my case, like how I did it. A definitely was university. So I studied a very specialized degree on my master's, which is innovation, technology, and the law. So a lot of my degree was about how you use, it had two streams. First was like how you regulate technology. And the second was how you use technology in legal services to make legal services more efficient, more streamlined, effective, etc. So a lot of the people that I knew from my master's and, you know, previous cohorts and subsequent cohorts, I already knew that these people were interested in legal tech. So I already had like a large community of people that would be enthusiastic about, you know, giving something a try. So that was definitely a big part of these efforts. Another thing was, you know, when I mentioned become part of associations, organizations, and networks. For example, I'm an ambassador of a community called Legal Ops Uncensored. It is one of the biggest global communities of legal technology and legal operations professionals. So these are people that work with legal teams to make decisions or to look into legal tech solutions and make decisions or advise legal teams with like what type of legal solutions they should be using, how they can, you know, streamline their operations, etc. So these communities really help you get valuable feedback and also like reach to people that, you know, you meet people that might not directly buy your product, but they might be like refer you to someone who could be interested in the product. And that's a big part of it. And I also mentioned going to legal tech conferences. For example, there are big legal tech conferences such as like Legal Gig, Clock, Legal Innovators, both in California and London. We've been to all of these conferences. There's also Legal Tech Talk happening in London this week on Thursday and Friday. So one of the opportunities is, you know, going to these conferences, meeting people. In fact, we're also part of Barclays Eagle Labs legal tech community, which is Barclays community that helps promising legal tech startups become, you know, industry ready, make connections, connect to investors, potential customers, and stuff like that. So through their support, we also had, for example, a booth at Legal Geek London last month. And that was a really great exposure for us to actually meet people, talk to them in person, see what they're doing, whether they would be interested in the product or not, and get a lot of useful feedback for that. So these are the type of things that we are trying to take advantage of. And it's been working, I think, more than some of the other things that we tested, which I spoke about earlier, like marketing and sales.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I think that's... especially maybe for techie people, it's like a hard topic, like going to conferences, talking to people, talking to customers. You were mentioning talking to customers before a lot. Do you think that's like one of the significant things which is part of your work right now, like talking to the people using the software?
I think if you stop talking to your customers at any point during building a startup, or once you've finished building a startup, you are doing something wrong, because you should be talking to your customers every day, no matter what stage you are at. So I think definitely for all of us at Lawformer, we're trying to make sure that we have some part of our time allocated to talking to our customers and understanding what they're doing and understanding what's working, what's not working. And that has been crucial for us throughout the journey, because, as I said earlier, we started with a product that was slightly different, and then how we got to our end product was entirely through our user feedback, because very consistent feedback we were getting was one-sided. So we're like, okay, we need to listen to these people, because these are our end users and they know what they need. To be honest, we all knew that from our experience within legal teams that knowledge management was a big problem. But I think we all kind of assumed that this might have been exclusive to our law firms. We probably thought, oh, maybe we're not doing something right. Maybe we're doing something wrong. Other teams are probably doing it better. But we soon realized that pretty much every single legal team is struggling with this. In fact, last week, I hosted a knowledge management webinar for a law firm, and we asked the panelists to rank legal teams that they worked with from 1 to 10 in terms of how good they are within their knowledge management efforts, and it has barely passed the mark of 5. So you can tell that this is something that is an industry-wide problem that we need to address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always confused by stories of people working with lawyers, but it's always on paper, or people are using how to say that in English, Faxgerät. Generally, like it's a word where I think I just use a fax machine. I just use the word in German because it's so old fashioned. I think vowel space is a little bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, like you see so much innovation happening, you're almost like deceived. You think, we're all so up to speed with everything. You'll see so many companies that still don't use like digital signatures. Yeah, they print documents and sign them and scan them. So much time wasted on that as well, when you already have like so many like free tools to administer. It's really interesting, but I think we are certainly moving that way, because it's not possible otherwise.
And I mean, especially with signatures. There are so good tools. Like I had GoSign in this podcast already. Really, really cool for signatures. DocuSign, I think, is the most famous one. I think it's just like stupid not using digital signature. I mean, like, depends if you're buying a house, maybe something different. But beside of it, yeah, I just think everyone should use digital signatures. I have questions about your founding team. I think I don't have enough female founders in that podcast, and you're a woman founded team, as I see on Crunchbase, which is really cool. Like you're a bigger team of founders, and I think 4 of you. And it's a woman-founded team, which is so cool, because I had a conversation recently about this podcast. A friend of mine was telling me, yeah, there should be more women in your podcast. And I'm like, yeah, it would be really cool. But I'm searching for female founders. How was it for you? Do you think it was any different founding as a woman? Do you think there were big advantages or disadvantages? Or is this even a topic to talk about? I don't know.
Certainly. I think, if you look at the statistics, right, I'm really glad you asked this question, by the way, because it's something that we talk a lot about, but we still don't talk enough about, I think. If you look at the statistics, like last year, only 2% of venture capital funding went towards female-founded startups. And I think companies with male CEOs raised like 5 times or 10 times more VC funding than female founded startups. That clearly shows that there's something that need to be fixed there, right? And law is not exception. Like you will see, you see more and more female partners now, but it's still very much a male dominated industry. And so we are a female founded, female led team. We have male founders as well, but it's 3 of us are female. So we dominate the team in that sense. And I would say, yes, as a woman, you face different challenges compared to men, especially in law and in tech, both of which are quite, you know, male dominated still. And I've spoken with so many female founders about this, and that they developed imposter syndrome through having so many conversations with men in VC. Because, and also, like, I'm currently part of a female founder accelerator in London, Vantage Female Founder Accelerator, that helps female founders gain investment and become investment ready in the UK. And it's really interesting to, we had conversations with VC funds in the very first week. And I mean, they are also not shying away from admitting that, you know, VCs have this inherent bias still. That's something that they're trying to eradicate, but it's still a fact that they're more confident in investing a male-led, male-founded startups than they are in female-founded startups. It's something that we need to address. I think it has been historically considered that men are better at running business than women are. That's something that I believe need to be challenged. I've seen a lot of unsuccessful male CEOs that just like ruin their companies through their unreasonable ambitions and ventures. But I also see a lot of amazing female founders that have been so level-headed, they've been so strategic in what they're doing. So within in our personal experience, obviously it came with challenges, but we still managed to raise pre-seed. And it has been really helpful in this process. And we've had support from a lot of, you know, female mentors and advisors that, you know, provided a lot of useful support in the process. But I would single-handedly say that it is a very hostile environment for female founders. But one thing I would recommend to any female founder listening to this is, do you find some, you know, female communities, female accelerators, female, you know, startup schools, because they have very niche experience in some of the issues that you will have to deal with along the way, and also some very first-hand experience of like how you can navigate the space. You don't want to come across as like constantly angry at someone because of, you know, the injustice that you will experience, which you will, because then you will antagonize people even more. They also need to know how to effectively navigate the space, because it is true, you will have to deal with some of these problems. So for me, that was a big factor, like having some support from other female founders and people who've already done it successfully, and we're happy to provide mentorship and support. That's a big aspect of it. And then someone might ask, how do we find these community? I literally found these communities on LinkedIn. You know, you can just use hashtag female community or female startup or female VC. And there are so many amazing people that are there to provide mentorship and also are happy to accept you within their community. So just look for resources, just use open source search. And yeah, if you're interested, I'm happy to provide more guidance on this. Feel free to reach out.
Oh, cool. That's a really cool offer by you. I think this imposter syndrome in general is a big topic for everyone who wants to build cool things, but especially for women. Like right now, we are hiring a really cool role, I would say, at the company where I'm employed, UserCentrics, and we so far don't have any female applications for this team lead role. Like we have, I don't know, like 100 applications and no woman at all applied for that role, and I think that's that's actually something which should change. I have an opinion about, so I was like, I think one or two times asked to invite 50-50 men and women to a podcast. And I think like, I don't know, I want to invite people where I think, okay, that's something cool the person built. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want to look at the gender for inviting people. But how would you think about that? So that's just a gut feeling. Maybe I'm completely wrong. I personally think I should invite people by what they build and not what gender they have. But maybe you have a different opinion. I think that's an interesting topic
it
to talk
really
about.
It depends on like the content or the your target audience, what they're interested in. I don't necessarily agree with like every single person need to try to, you know, go at length to make sure that they have a female person on the podcast every other week. I think it would be good for you to look into if there are interesting female founders that you can talk to, because they will have very different perspectives and they will also enrich your content. But if you feel like someone's like massively underqualified or has no idea what they're talking about, it's not your responsibility to be doing that. But obviously, it's really good to support people where you can, and female founders and female, you know, people in tech, female person. We need support. And you are mentioning imposter syndrome, and that's something like I was reading this study. I don't remember the percentage, but it said that women are way less likely to apply for jobs and positions that they're underqualified for than male candidates. Like, men just go for it and women always second guess themselves. I remember a few years ago I was filling out this application for scholarship. And I put together all of the stuff that I had done and participated and achieved. And I was looking at it and I was like, I was telling my sister, it's like, I feel like I've not done these things. I feel like I'm lying or cheating or, you know, I'm deceiving someone. And she was like, you've done this, you've done this. Like, you've done all of these. What are you talking about? It's like, I know I've actually done all of these things, but it almost feels like I didn't. And I'm also like fairly confident person. I wouldn't say I necessarily ever struggled with like self-doubt or anything like that. But it still affected me at so many stages in my life. And I believe that's the same for a lot of people. And you mentioned that you were hiring at the moment, but there's no female applications there. Yeah, it is, you know, it's hard because it's like a circle, right? You have people discouraged to be in tech. And obviously you get less women involved in tech and then less candidates applying for the job that you're advertising. So I think, you know, providing support and making it very clear in your statement that you encourage female candidates to like some companies even have like female mentorship or female support programs. They also, some software companies even provide specific trainings for women that don't necessarily meet the criteria to be there, but they want to support them. And of course, like if this is going to break your funding or make you bankrupt by the end of the year, nobody's expecting you to do it. But if you have the means to, and if that's something that would support your mission, then, you know, it would be good to think about it, because I know that a lot of women would probably look at it and think, yeah, oh, this would be very interesting, but I'm not qualified for it.
And you were mentioning something really interesting. You said, okay, I looked at this profile of a job description, and I did all of this before. And I think especially like with being a founder, you didn't do this before. Like, it's obviously the first time you're building a company, you're doing all of this, and that's not a problem at all. I also think it's a great idea to apply for a job where you're not 100% qualified, because we're else to learn all these kind of things. At least maybe if you know 80% of the things, the other 20% probably you can learn by doing, and probably you will have some mentors who tell you how to do it. And especially with founding a company, I think there are really great resources and people supporting you on that way. Yeah.
Yeah, I often feel like I often say this to myself. There are probably so many people who look at me and think that I have everything figured out. I know what I'm doing. I, you know, like fairly confident in what I'm doing, etc. But there are so many moments, so many days when I just don't feel like I know what I'm doing. And honestly, it's being a founder is a very inconsistent journey. There's so many ups and downs. Even like within one day, you can go through so many different emotions. You might feel like you're doing amazing in the morning at 5 a.m. You're struggling and like failing and not doing anything right. So I think it's really, it's just a mindset shift. So for me, I had to accept the fact that there were lots of things I didn't know. There are lots of things that I needed to learn. And I just told myself the best way to learn is to learn by doing. I had calls where I came away feeling embarrassed because I just couldn't explain something properly, or I didn't communicate something properly, or I felt like I was underprepared, or I got an email that basically explained to me why I'm bad at what I'm doing or why my product is bad. It's the whole journey is full of stuff like that. You just need to keep moving forward. You're never going to be perfect. There's always going to be something you don't know. Just make sure that you approach people that are there to teach you things. For example, going back to, you know, empowering women. So we've had so many female interns at law firm, because I feel like them seeing that we're a team of female founders, they naturally feel more inclined to apply and safer within the female team. And most of our, actually, like most of our interns along the way have been women, and it's really great to help them grow, to see the experience they're having, the journey they're going through. And I think that's one of the things, like if companies have more women in the management team, whether it's a VC fund, whether it's a software company, a law firm, or anything, then you will naturally attract more female candidates, because they will automatically feel like this is an environment that's not hostile to women, and they will identify and see themselves in this person that's already there at the top of the management. And I think that's been a big part of our journey so far.
Yeah, I really like everything you said. I hope it's inspiring to someone, and someone decides to build a company who was struggling with that decision before.
Yeah, and also the other thing for women is education. Like, we don't get a lot of tech education or business education, at least like where I come from. I come from Georgia, and I feel like growing up, I never thought I was particularly entrepreneurial, because I was always told that I had to go for like a safer career route, like being in law or some traditional industry. Hustling wasn't something that was associated with women. And we don't even, like, the education failed us in a sense that they don't really teach you financial skills. They don't teach you business skills. And I know that that's not the same everywhere. But for example, in Sweden, at school, they teach like students how to build their own company from scratch. And obviously, like, those people are going to be much more successful in their journey. So I think education is a massive part of it. And people, schools and education systems, that we really have to understand the importance of business skills and financial literacy to support entrepreneurship early on.
Talking about Georgia, I saw that like the biggest part of your founding team is sitting in Georgia, I guess also the biggest part of your company in general. Your company is located in the United States, mm-hmm. and the creators in Seattle area, but do you think there were like some challenges with coming from Georgia, also getting the first founding round with 100K from Noxton within Georgia, mm-hmm. and not like starting in the US or like in, I don't know, Germany, UK, etc.?
Yeah, I think yes, there are certain challenges involved with that, because I think the biggest challenge is making sure that you have presence where you're trying to build the product. And we tried to make sure that we were spending time in the US and going to conferences and meeting people and sort of like had developed some sort of network in this community. And what I was talking about earlier, being part of a global network that has like legal professionals from all over the world, was a big part of it. And that was something that we were trying to balance. I think what helped in our case is that we had previously all studied and worked abroad. So most of our legal network was already in those countries, in the UK and in the US. So when we needed to leverage that for our product that was there and available to us, one thing that's helpful is that, for example, Law Firm AI is a jurisdiction agnostic tool. That means that it can be used to deconstruct and work with and build libraries within any jurisdiction. It doesn't have to be in any specific jurisdiction, because that would limit our scalability and market opportunity as well. But that's not really a barrier. So that just means that, we just try to develop as much presence on that market as possible, and then eventually relocate to where we have most traction and continue to build a product there, which mm-hmm. has always been the strategy mm-hmm. yeah. for us.
But was it a strategic decision to settle in Seattle and you moving to London?
Oh, so like we were looking at like where to start the company. It, for most startups, it's Silicon Valley, because that's where most of the opportunity is. It might necessarily be true for legal tech, because we found out that, for example, a lot of opportunities are in New York, because there are a lot of law firms there that are potential customers. So that's like one area that we're really, really looking at and, zooming in on more, because, I understand for tech, it's usually like Silicon Valley area that provides potential, but for legal tech startups, it could be New York and DC. So that's some of the, we're looking at like big corporate centers where.
Yeah. So it's a lot about, especially in law, going to where the magic happens and talking to the people in person. So you also think it's still a lot about being in person where, wherever people are, like digitally, I guess still there's a little difference in meeting people and building trust.
For example, like the conferences I was mentioning, it's really always really good to travel to those conferences and make sure you use those 3 days or whatever you have to talk to those people, because relationship building, you can do a lot virtually. You can reach out to people on LinkedIn, you can make referrals, you can have calls. But a lot of relationship building still happens in person. So if you have the opportunity, I understand it can be really costly, but if you have the opportunity, it pays off. I think it's always worth investing it, especially in like traditional fields like law, where a lot of it still depends on like building those connections. Like if you're building a different type of startup, you might not even have to get anywhere, especially when it comes to like B2C startups, maybe.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you so much, Mariam, for showing me a little bit around about I personally think that's one of the toughest things, like building this network and like building audience and building like public relations in some way, like or the other, especially in such a like old industry, I would say. But yeah, I think it's really cool what you built with Lawformer, and all the best for the future of Lawformer. I'm excited to what AI brings in the next years here.
Thank you so much. It was great chatting with you, and good luck in your journey as well. I hope in 10 years time I look at your company and congratulate on how successful it is.
Hope so.
As well. And thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
Very, very happy to have you too. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode today. Give this episode a like, comment, like the podcast, give it a thumbs up, 5 stars, share it with friends, share it with like people who could be interested, whatever is possible on your platform. Thank you so much for your support. Happy to see you next time again. And thank you so much, Mariam, for being today on the call. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.